Sorry for the delay. I seem to have trouble with my computer. The idea is that this is supposed to be an opportunity for you to ask questions. I received quite a few emails, about 6, 7, or 8, and I was going to first go through the questions that were on, that were in these emails, and try to answer at least some of them. And then I would like to give you the opportunity to ask further questions, although I haven't actually prepared a proper presentation in the sense of giving you new input, new slides, or something like that. And if so, then I couldn't show them to you at the moment anyway. So, I also have a microphone. This is being recorded. And the microphone is meant for people asking questions because it really doesn't make sense for the questions not to be heard on the recording equipment. So it'll be a bit awkward to sort of pass it round, but I think it's the only way for those people who really, really wanted to be here but couldn't to hear what's going on. So we'll have to work with this. Good. So what I suggest is that I just basically read the emails that I got and then say what I have to say about them, and we'll have to take it from there. Does that sound like a plan? Okay, I had a question from one student who says, I have a question regarding morphology and phonology. Could we have a detailed look at the differences between a morpheme and a phoneme, and a morph and a phone, and an allomorph and an allophone? I was kind of expecting that question. I had also hoped that I would have managed to get this idea across, but apparently I didn't get this across to everyone. What is a phoneme? What is a morpheme? Well, the phoneme and the morpheme are both smallest units of something, but not smallest units of the same thing. What is a phoneme? The smallest meaning distinguishing element of language. Yeah? This is from the slides. You don't need to write this down. Everything is there. Okay. What is a morpheme? The smallest meaningful unit of language. So when we talk about phonemes, we're talking about a different level of linguistic description. Okay. Phonemes have to do with sounds of English, or sounds of German, sounds of whatever language you're looking at, and morphemes have to do with the building blocks of words. So it's higher up in the hierarchy. I think that's simple, right? The main problem is the distinction between morphemes, morphs, and allomorphs, and phonemes, phones, and allophones, right? Is that the problem? Okay. And I'm not quite sure how to answer this because I've tried several times. I can give you one or two examples again. For example, if we look at the word put, how many sounds, how many phonemes do we have? 3, yeah? P, U, T. And you will be expected to describe them in the exam. There will be a question which says, give a full description of the following IPA symbol or of the following phoneme. Okay. And if it's P, then the answer is bilabial plosive and voiceless. Okay, you need to give all 3 parts: voicing, manner, and place of articulation. Yeah? And if you don't, then it's not a complete description. Okay, right. So we now know what P is in put. Let's look at another word like traps, or maps, or any other word with P that doesn't start with P. He traps people. Okay. Is this the same P as in put? Yes, on one level, in the sense that it's the same phoneme. But no, on another level, because there is a difference. And that difference we try to explain, or I try to explain, by looking at what happens when you put your hand in front of your mouth. If you say put, put, do it again, please, put, then you feel something, right? I know this is embarrassing, you can still try it out, okay? Put. You know? If you say maps or traps, you don't feel anything. You know? There is no, well, there is some, but there is much less air coming out of your mouth at the time when you create the plosive. This is because of where this p is located in the word. If it's at the beginning of the word, or of the syllable, then there are different rules or different things happen. Why is maybe not so important at the moment. But the p at the beginning of the word put is not, from an acoustic point of view, the same p as in traps. Is it the same thing? Yes, on an abstract level, in the sense that it's the same phoneme, but it is realized in different ways. And theoretically, this doesn't happen, theoretically, if you were to produce the word put without aspiration in this case is, in this example, is what's different, and you said something like, well, it's difficult to do, put, 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 then you would probably still be able to interpret this as a P, but it just doesn't happen. It's because at the beginning of a syllable, P's are aspirated. If you replace it with a different phoneme, could, I don't know, if you're a northerner or any other, then yes, it's clearly something different. But basically, both maps, the P in P, in maps, and the P in put, are the same meaning distinguishing unit, but they are, because of the positioning in the word, realized differently. They are allophones of the same phoneme. Yeah? And phonemes are things that are that are specific to language, to a language, sorry. There are phonemes in English which are not realized, or which are not phonemes in other languages. Remember, I gave you the example of the Spanish speaker who doesn't distinguish between vowels and vowels. That's because b and v are allophones in Spanish. There is no word, there is no set of words in Spanish where b and v produce a minimal pair. Of course, there are words in English where b and v produce a minimal pair. Vowels and vowels, for example. But because the phoneme setup or the system of Spanish is different, the two distinct phonemes in English are actually interpreted as allophones in Spanish. Is that difficult? No? And basically, the same thing happens with morphemes. It's just that we are one level higher up. Morphemes are the smallest meaningful units of language. Okay? Meaning that when we look at a morpheme, or the realization of a morpheme, then this means something. P doesn't mean anything. But map means something, or put means something. And if I say puts, then ts means something. It means something grammatical, but it means something. So sometimes a morpheme can only be Well, it can be realized by only one phoneme, yes. Sometimes there is overlap, but it's still on a different level of linguistic description. Okay. Now, as with phonemes on the level of morphemes, there are different ways of doing the same thing, or different ways of meaning the same thing. And the example that we used was the plural example, or the plural. Whether I say oxen, whether I say students, or whether I say cars, I'm always using an element of a word to indicate plural. I'm always using a morpheme which means plural. But z and s and n are three different realizations of this meaning. They are allomorphs. I really don't know how else to explain it. Mm-hmm. If you've got two words like, for example, sings and students, we have two S's. One is a voiced and one is voiceless. Are they allomorphs? Is the S in students and he sings? Are those two allomorphs? Who's in favor of it? Who thinks they're not? Yes, they're not, that's true. Why? Because he sings means third person singular present tense. And students, one student, two students, more of you, means plural. Huh? So, morphology is about meaning carrying elements, and we only talk about allomorphs if we are talking about different realizations of the same meaning. And we only talk about allophones if we talk about different ways the same phoneme in a particular language can be realized. And what is a phoneme in Spanish with its different realizations may not be the same as a phoneme in German or in English and its different realizations. Is that clear? Okay. Right. I have a question regarding the speech acts and sentence types. In the lecture, we have learned about three sentence types: imperative, interrogative, and declarative. Yeah. And four speech acts: command, question, assertion, and request. Well, actually, on one slide, there were a few more. There were requests, commands, apologies, threats, compliments, warnings, advice, assertions, etc. The point is, you do not need to know them by heart. And linguists disagree on the full list of speech act types. Mm-hmm. You need to know the concept. And if you see a promise, then it would be nice to realize that it's a promise, but I'm not going to ask specific questions about different types of speech acts. Okay. So I would like to keep it simple here and not ask you to learn things by heart, in the sense that you have to list, I don't know, sometimes there are 12, 13, 14 different speech act types. That's not necessary. You need to know the concept of speech act, what it means, how it is done, how we make sense of speech acts, etc. But not more than that. Does that answer the question? So the question was basically, are those the only sentence types? Yes. I mean, sentence types are something completely different, of course. But the point that we made is that sentence times are related to speech acts, yeah, but that they, in fact, don't need to be fully correlated. Not every interrogative is a question. Not every imperative is a command. That's exactly the point of speech act theory. Okay. Right. I need some further clarification for a few terms. Yes? Reference. No, I don't have any. Ah, here. Okay. Okay, what's at issue when we talk about reference? First of all, I made the distinction between the actual act of referring. So if I say this is a chair, then a chair is the referring expression that refers, in this case, to this particular chair. Well, this is my chair, something like that. So a referring expression refers to a referent. Okay. And we looked at different types of reference. And I think that's maybe where the difficulties are. What are the different types? Well, we have two types, really, or two oppositions. Definite versus indefinite. And specific versus non-specific. Do I need to explain those again? Is that a yes or a no? No? Yes. Okay. Yeah. Well, definite versus indefinite, I think that should be fairly clear. A chair versus the chair. Yeah? Okay. You can usually see this very clearly when you look at the referring expression. Does it have a definite article or not? Okay. Specific versus non-specific is a bit more difficult as a concept. If I say to my colleagues over lunch, I'm going to give a student a 1 today, the mark, the grade 1. There are two ways in which I can mean this. I have just marked the paper, and it was a brilliant paper, and this student is going to get a 1 from me. And I'm just not mentioning the name, but I'm saying I'm going to give a student a 1. And I know exactly which student it is. And I could say, she's called whatever. Or I can just decide that today I'm in a very generous mood, and all of you who've submitted work, even though I haven't read it yet, I'm just going to say I'm going to give a student, at least 1, okay, a 1. And who of you it is, I don't know. One of you is going to be lucky, whether it's because of such wonderful work or whether I just have decided that one of you is going to get a 1. This is an example of non-specific reference. There will eventually be one particular referent who is happy about receiving a 1. Okay? But at the moment, it's not specified yet. My example was I'm going to go to IKEA to buy a chair. I have no idea which one it is. I may know the model, but it has no specific reference in the sense that I could touch it. Yeah? Often, definite reference is used when we're talking about something that has specific reference. But there are examples where the opposite is the case. So there are two different things, definite versus indefinite, and specific versus non-specific. Does that answer the question? Yeah? Okay, the other term that the student wanted to know about is face-threatening act, because he or she didn't know how to explain it. And there was another person who was worried about face and face-threatening acts and the whole of politeness theory. What is a face-threatening act? A face-threatening act is anything that has an impact on a person's positive or negative face. What's positive and negative face? Well, face is basically a concept from sociology, as I said, Goffman. And you know face. You know about losing face. Right? You know about embarrassing yourself because you've done something silly, for example. And then you lose a certain... Well, in a way, of a certain bit of social value or whatever, you feel that you've done something silly. Mm-hmm. Now, face in terms of linguistics is typically distinguished in terms of positive and negative face. Mm-hmm. Positive face refers to your want to be part of your society, your group of people, of being liked, of being part of it. Mm-hmm. And negative face refers to your want to be independent, to be left alone, to be your own master, to be responsible for your own acts. The idea is that if I, as a speaker, interact with you, then I'm constantly risking to either attack your positive or your negative face. How? Well, I might ask you to do something for me. If I ask you to do something for me, then that is potentially not what you want, because it interferes with your independence. Or if I say something negative about you, I hand you back a term paper or an exam and say, I'm sorry, this was not really very successful. I am attacking your face. And because we are social beings and we need each other in various ways, we constantly seem to be weighing up the pros and the cons of doing something nasty. Nasty in the sense that it attacks your face. I may decide that it's too much of a face threat to ask you to do something. Or I may decide that I need to be very careful in communicating a bad mark to you. And then I will, for example, say things like, sorry, but this was not very good. I could just say, this isn't good. And it would get across differently to you from saying, sorry, this wasn't very good. Because by saying sorry, I'm taking care of your positive face by showing awareness of your need to be part of society, liked, part of being a student, etc. Yeah? For example. So, a face threat is basically any verbal action that attacks either your positive or your negative face needs. And there are various ways in which we can deal with this, and that's this schema that you can look at in the slides, on the slides, where we have this, I mean, this is the Brown-Levinson, this kind of, right, don't do it with redressive action, do it with positive or negative politeness, and do it bold on without any redressive action. Yeah? Not going to copy this, it was on the slides, but if you don't know what I'm talking about, it's in the slides. Yeah? This is the one where we say negative and positive politeness is taken care of. So, sorry, this was not very good. Okay. And this one is the one where we're basically using an indirect speech act. So if I want money from you and say, oh no, I've forgotten my wallet again, that was a typical example that I gave you, then this is done indirectly because I can always say, I didn't ask for it. Yeah? So the redressive action is basically being very indirect in making sure that, well, in basically producing something, a speech act that is cancelable. And that is less of a less of an attack on your face than the one where I can't say I didn't mean it. I really mean that this is a bad paper, but. Okay? But it is less damaging to your face than saying, this is crap. Yeah? Or for whatever reason, unlikely in this situation, because I need to tell you whether you did well or not, I might decide you can't handle it, or it's too risky for whatever reason to tell you, and therefore I decide not to do the face-threatening act. Does that help? Okay. Email 4. Are the in bath and the in the both dental concerning their place of articulation? Well, what else could they be? I didn't quite understand that question. I didn't know what the issue was. If the person who asked the question is here, maybe they can tell me, but... I mean, the TH is always dental. Yeah? You might have a voiced or a voiceless version, but it's dental or interdental. I accept both. All right? If you want us to describe sounds, do you want us to analyze their place, manner, etc.? Yes. Okay? Yes, absolutely. Place, manner, voicing. And if it's vowels, then of course not voicing, because all vowels are voiced. But then you need to talk about front and back and mid and high and low. Yeah? And all right? Next question. Would you please repeat the context of prescriptive and descriptive approaches? Again, I wasn't quite sure what I was supposed to answer here. I made the point that there is a distinction between people who are prescriptive or proscriptive in the sense that they know what's good or bad about language, and that it's bad to split your infinitive or something like that. And I made the point that we, when we do linguistics, do not generally, or just basically, I hope, do not make value judgments. But we describe rather than pre or proscribe. Prescribe in the sense this has to be like that, or proscribe you shouldn't. Okay. So linguistics takes an approach that anything, or takes the approach that anything that is used in language is worth describing, and that it's not good or bad. So yes, we talk about standard or non-standard dialects, for example. But we're not talking about non-standard dialects in the sense that this is bad and therefore should be prohibited or avoided or something like that. But we're basically looking at the system of different varieties, dialects, languages, and we describe how they differ. That's the descriptive approach, and that's the one that basically we use for the whole semester. There isn't much more to that, really, I think. Okay? Could you please repeat some input to the topic of identifying syllables? Again, I wasn't quite sure what was meant by the topic of identifying syllables. I mean, this, we had a, at the end of one session, I talked about syllables. I talked about things like onset and rhyme and nucleus and coda and whether it's a heavy syllable or a light syllable. And I gave some more advanced pieces of information regarding onset maximization and things like that. I mean, forget about onset maximization and things like that. This is not part of the exam. Okay, this was also specifically marked as for people who want to know more. Yes, it's in the reading as well. It's in the chapter, if I remember correctly, on one of the phonology ones. But no, I'm not going to give you two syllables and ask you to distinguish between... explain why the syllable structure is the way it is. Okay. So in that sense, I wouldn't really like to go into detail here now, because it's for those people who are interested, read it again, and if there are questions, you're always welcome to come and talk to me in my office hour. But there are not going to be any detailed questions about syllable structure, so I would suggest we just skip it. Yeah? I'm not saying it's not interesting or it's not relevant. But it's more detailed knowledge than needs to be learnt for the exam. Okay. Motivating why different syllables are separated at a particular point, etc. Okay? Could you explain the difference between intrasentential and suprasentential anaphoric reference again? Is the only difference the fact that suprasentential anaphonic reference is linked to more than one sentence, whereas the intrasentential is not? Well, I wouldn't say linked to more than one sentence, but linked that the reference is across two sentences. So if I have a sentence, the student was a very diligent person. She always finished her work on time. What's the anaphoric referring expression? She. What does it refer back to? Not student, but the student. Okay? Right? Because that's referring back to the whole noun phrase. Is it across two sentences? Yes. In that sense, it is suprasentential. You can also have anaphoric reference within a sentence. My teacher said that he didn't like my essay. Okay, this is on different clause levels. My teacher said something is the main clause, the matrix clause, and that he didn't like my essay. This is a that clause, a subordinate clause, and we are on two different levels, but it's still within the same sentence. So this is intrasentential anaphoric reference. So yes, it is as simple as that. It's just, is it more than one sentence involved or not? All right? Oh yes, and there was the question, what is meant by overt marker on the slide? And that refers to the slide on anaphoric reference, where I gave the example, Americans are much better at this than we are. They inquire more. They refers back to Americans. They are not content to just rest on their laurels. Okay. It links two or more sentences. That's what it said on the slide. And this is an overt marker in the sense that you can see it. It's there. It's a grammatical feature of the language. Why do I mention overt marker? Because we also looked at the concept of coherence. Coherence is something that takes care of the fact that we tend to see two sentences that are next to each other as something that belongs to each other. But it is not typically done by any overt markers. Okay. I don't know whether that was the example, but a typical example is an earthquake happened at 4 a.m., a three-car crash happened. Is there an overt relationship between the fact that an earthquake happened and that the three cars crashed? Well, not overt in the sense that there is a lexical marker, like an anaphoric pronoun, that links the two elements. But if we hear those two sentences, we immediately draw a connection between them. We create coherence. We believe that this is a causal connection. We believe that the cars probably crashed because of the earthquake. But that's not really an interpretation that is in the forms that are used to make the sentences. Theoretically, it is compatible with a situation where there is an earthquake in Japan and somewhere in Buenos Aires three cars crash. But why would you say that then? So coherence is something more pragmatic in the sense that we believe that something is relevant if two things happen or are said or are reported next to each other or following each other. But it's not as if there was an overt marker that sort of forced that interpretation on us. If I say my teacher is a great person, he always gives me good grades, then I would find it much more difficult to say that he does not refer to the teacher, because it's an overt element that requires, he requires something that needs to be referred to. My teacher is a great person. I always receive top grades. Same message, but it's much less obvious from a grammatical, from a point of view of the words used, that it is the teacher who actually gives me good grades. And in fact, it will be, but it's done via a different mechanism. One mechanism is cohesion, which works on a syntactic, semantic level in the sense that there are overt links. And the other one is on a semantic, pragmatic level in the sense that we interpret, we draw implicatures about what we believe to be the case. And remember when we talked about adjacency pairs, I said that adjacency pairs are very fundamental to our communication because we believe, well, we work on the assumption that two things that are set next to each other need to have some relevance for each other. It doesn't make sense to say something if it isn't related to what was previously said. At least we assume. Okay? That explains overt marker. Week 8, slide 61. The streets being completely deserted, Jackie preferred to take a taxi. How would the syntax tree look like? I would like to answer this question with, don't worry. Because, yes, we can draw a syntax tree of this. But it's going to be more complex than I would like you to be able to grasp at the moment. What is complex about this? Well, the streets being completely deserted, it's a non-finite subordinate clause. So how do we do this in a tree? Well, we've done this before, but... And Jackie preferred to take a taxi. How many clauses do we have here? Jackie preferred to take a taxi? Two, yes, prefer and to take. Yeah. So Jackie preferred to take a taxi is Jackie preferred object. So basically, I'm not drawing the whole tree, but Jackie the verb phrase would be prefer to take a taxi. Okay. Preferred. And how is the object realized? To take a taxi, which is a subordinate clause, which is a non-finite clause without a subject of its own. So preferred, Jackie preferred Jackie to take a taxi. Yeah, or Jackie preferred Jackie take a taxi. So what we would actually have here is another S. But the S doesn't have a subject because it's only a verb phrase and the subject is empty. Because it's the same as Jackie. Oops. Yeah? And where do we put the streets being completely deserted? Well, somehow it belongs up here. Because it says it's an adverbial or a reason why this is the case. So we would have to find a way, and that's where it becomes a bit more complex or more confusing. We would have to find a way of attaching a second sentence, a subordinate clause again. Now, this is not what it would look like if we drew it, if we did it properly, but we haven't actually looked at how to attach such clauses on the sentence level. So that's why I wouldn't like to go into any greater detail. The important things in this sentence is you need to be able to know what is the streets being completely deserted. You need to be able to see that this is non-finite. You need to be able to see that this is a subordinating, that this is a subordinated clause. It's not a matrix clause. You need to be able to find out how many clauses are there are in the whole sentence. Three. Huh? That's it, basically. But I don't ask you to draw trees in the exam. I might ask you to read trees. You know, you need to be able to understand what's going on. I might do that. But I will not ask you to draw a tree. All right? Now, next question. Week 9, slide 70. What does spec mean? Yes, this was the last slide of the lecture, and this was this bit where basically a very abstract tree was shown, and here it said spec. Now this is something that, and the point was that X-bar theory assumes that all phrases are internally the same. Okay. There are complements, there are adjuncts, there are heads, and then there are specifiers. Okay. Don't worry about it. Yeah? Because we're not doing X-bar syntax, this is something for more advanced levels. The basic point is that complement and adjunct, that any phrase has the same structure, whether it's a noun phrase, a verb phrase, an adjective phrase, an adverb phrase, and with a in order to be able to make this apply to all phrases, we can't have something like determiner or something like that, because there are no determiners in adverb phrases or something like that. And that's why people call it specifier. But not for the exam. All right? Okay, and then the last question of this email was about face-threatening acts. What's the difference between positive and negative politeness? I think we've covered that. Both are described with do the FTA, but use some redressive action. I hope I've explained that. Redressive action is basically a strategy to reduce the face threat, and whether you use something that takes care of your positive or your negative face, you might use different strategies, but in both cases, it is action that reduces the face threat. So I think that should have been covered. Oh no, there was something on... Oh yeah, week 11, slide 37. Is this Wittgenstein's explanation or definition of the prototype theory, and what does he mean saying that? And this basically refers to the quote that I gave you from Wittgenstein's Logic of Language. I can think of no better expression to characterize these similarities. This was about games, about the fact that we have this concept of game, but if you look at different games, you will always find one or other way where things are not shared. With some games there is a ball, but there are lots of games without balls. With some there is a competitor, with some there are no competitors. Some are group games, some others are individuals against each other, etc., etc. And how come, basically, that we still call all of these games? Well, basically it's a family, and there are resemblances, but there isn't one single feature which always can be mentioned. It's games form a family. Okay. And no, this is not the definition of prototype theory, in the sense that Wittgenstein founded it. But it's the idea behind the people who did prototype theory in linguistics, because that's basically the observation that the philosopher made about language, and then this was developed into prototype theory. fact that some members of the family are more typical of others. A penguin is a bird, even though it can't fly. But a robin is a much more typical, prototypical bird. Right. What is implicature and flouting? Yes. What is implicature? Well, this basically is, of course, about speech acts and speech act theory and about the way we interpret an utterance, a locution, to mean something. And that something is potentially very different from the semantic content of the words of the sentence or the utterance that I make. An illocution, no, an implicature is basically the interpretation that we produce, that we come to when making sense of an utterance in context. So we might see something that is implied rather than logically entailed. Okay, the example I think that I gave in the lecture was, what was it with the Toyota? And if I say John drives a Toyota, then I automatically also say that he drives a car. That's because there is a logical relationship between the two. But if I say that the house is on fire because there is smoke coming from it, then that's an implicature. Well, we draw the conclusion that this is because it's on fire. But that's not a logical relationship. And in the same way with language, when I say, basically with any indirect speech act, we rely on implicatures to make sense. For example, if I now say, I'm getting hungry, then this could be interpreted as meaning that I'd really like to stop this session now. Yeah? On the other hand, it could just mean that I'm getting hungry and that I'm perfectly happy to go on. It's your interpretation of my statement, my locution, I am getting hungry, in the right context. And some of you may think, oh no, he's just saying he's hungry, he's happy to go on. And others may think, need to stop soon. But that's perhaps just because you interpret things differently. And that's basically negotiation between speakers and hearers. But the important point is interpretation in context. That's an implicature. Or making sense of the interpretation in context. And face and politeness and all of this comes into this. I may find it inappropriate to let you or to send you off because I want to have lunch. I mean, I could decide to just say, I'm hungry, I'm going. But I might think that this is too much of a face threat to either myself or to you. And I might like to couch it in different terms. I might do it indirectly and rely on the fact that you draw the correct implicatures, namely, he actually wants to stop. Does that help? If I receive a very simple question, and if I answer this by, have you studied for the exam? What do I mean? Well, I might either be simply interested in, have you studied for the exam? Or I might actually want to tell you, this is such a basic question that you shouldn't really ask that question. But that relies on you interpreting my intended meaning in the right context. It relies on you drawing this implicature. And it may work or not. And if you get angry because I say, because I attack your face basically by telling me you haven't started practicing yet or learning yet, then I can say, oh, no, I just wanted to know because, I mean, I don't know when students start learning. I think it's perfectly okay. Yeah? But that's because the communication that I tried to, or the message that I tried to get across was hidden with redressive action, but this redressive action is not redressive action. Well, no, sorry, forget this redressive action bit. It was hidden behind an indirect speech act. All right? Is it possible to repeat the whole face theory? No, and we've almost done it already. Listen to the lecture again. And then I got an email in German. Was genau kann man als Tabus definieren? Alltagssprachlich ist das wohl klar, aber mir ist der Unterschied zwischen Tabus und rude words nicht ganz klar. Well, taboo is almost like an umbrella term. There are rude words, and they are part of taboo. But there can be other reasons for something being taboo. For example, religion. And therefore, you may decide that uttering, I don't know, the name of a religious figure or whatever is not appropriate in a particular context, and it's prohibited by social rules. That would be just as much taboo as saying a four-letter word. Yeah? Fine? Bei der Semantik stellt sich mir nur eine Frage. Ich kenne Polysemie und Homonymie schon aus dem Deutschen. Da hatten wir den Unterschied so erklärt, dass beide zwar in Schrift und Lautung identisch sind, allerdings dadurch zu unterscheiden sind, dass die Wörter bei Polysemie denselben etymologischen Hintergrund haben, wie zum Beispiel bei Bank Bank, und bei Homonymie eben nicht, also die eindeutige Klärung nur mit Hilfe eines etymologischen Wörterbuchs möglich ist. Yes? Good, ja? Yeah. Anfangs hatte ich das mit Ihren Folien auch so verstanden. I'm not making fun of the person, but the situation, yeah. Allerdings hatte mich der Absatz in unserem Buch dazu doch verwirrt. And I don't understand this. I don't know what the problem is with the Absatz in unserem Buch. But basically what you say is right. Does the person who wrote that to me want to explain where the problem is, or? Okay. But basically, that definition is fine with me. Yeah? And the difficulty lies, in fact, in the situation that we often do not have etymological knowledge at hand. I mean, we don't know that two words are related. And yes, I mean, as it said in the assignment, for those of you who did it, or that was one of the things he needed to explain. Go to an etymological dictionary, go to the Oxford English Dictionary, and you will find out things about words that you wouldn't feel to be the case intuitively. Mm-hmm. So that's why it's sometimes difficult to distinguish between polysemy and homonymy. Okay. I think that's... No, we're almost there. Yeah, and then the person had problems about Übungen betreffend der Dialects. And I don't know what that was. Did we have any exercises with dialects? No. So I think that was a different course. Not sure. Can't answer that question. Okay, it would be great if the following question, that's the last one, could be answered in the revision session. Is there any concrete definition of face? Well, I think we've covered face, right? Could you please give another example of locution and illocution? Well, in a way, I've done that already. If I say, this is my seat, this could mean various things in the right context. It can be a threat, it can be a statement, it can be a promise, it can be anything, right? Those of you who did the assignment, I think in this assignment there was a question where it asked about what speech act is the following utterance, and I don't know whether it was great work or something like that. Really, the only best answer, the best answer was, it depends. Yeah, that was full marks. Because it depends on context. Because anything can mean absolutely anything in the right context. And if you wrote compliment, or anything else, or statement, or assertion, or whatever, you got 2 points for it. Because it's a meaningful response, but it doesn't capture the fact that there's more to it. Right, that's as much as I wanted to say. Are there further questions, either from the point of view of formal aspects, organization, or content?
Hello?
Yes, it works.
there was a sentence where I had to define which speech act is performed. And the sentence was, I'm going to hit you. I wasn't sure what it was, so.
Well, what could it be? What's the correct answer to what speech act is performed by I'm going to hit you?
It depends.
It depends, yes, it depends. I agree, it makes sense to say it's probably a threat. Yeah? But imagine that you're practicing for a rehearsal or whatever, and you're going through the different stages, and then you're going to jump down there, and then what's going to happen next? Oh, I'm going to hit you. All right? Right? Yes, I agree. There is a sort of default interpretation. But that's just because we make up a situation in our minds which we think is very typical. But there is nothing in I am going to hit you itself from a linguistic point of view which says this must be a threat. Any other questions? You will be recorded.
I have a question. Is it possible to upload all answer sheets of the tutorial exercises?
Yes. Yes, I've been fearing that question for a while. Yes. I'll try to do this, yes. I've been wanting to do this for a long time. I've done a couple, right? I've done a couple, but not all of them. Yes, this has to do with the fact that I had them and then lost them. And I... yes. Yeah, I'd do my best. Okay. I'm leaving for Finland tomorrow. I'm actually not going to be here during the exam. It's work. It's not holidays, but I'll try. Okay. Any other face-threatening questions? that was an interesting way.
Are we allowed to use the IPA chart or monolingual dictionary?
No. 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 There. Yeah. No. No regressive action. No, there are exams later on, I think, or there used to be exams where you can have a monolingual dictionary, but not in this exam. Yeah. No, you need to learn the IPA chart. I mean, if I allowed you to bring along the IPA chart, then basically 5 points would be just yours, right? I'm happy to give you 5 points, but basically I'm already telling you, you need to know the symbols, the IPA symbols for the sounds of English. Okay, you don't need to know the IPA symbols for the sounds of languages spoken in Papua New Guinea. Okay? You don't need to know the complete chart, the ones that we covered. Okay. Before the next question, if there is a next question, in the assignment, the second assignment, there were again quite a few people who did not produce examples when they were asked to produce examples, and even more silly, who didn't underline when they were asked to underline. And there is no other way for me to deal with this than just not give you the points for it. Even if I think that the answer that you gave me is probably is probably correct. Mm-hmm. So in the exam script itself, I think I've put it bold and I underlined it or something like that. But you give away points that you don't need to give away by not underlining when I ask for underlining. I'm absolutely sure it'll happen again. Because it, for some reason, always happens. Okay? But I always feel bad about doing it, but I can't give you marks for anything if it asks you to underline and you don't. Mm-hmm. And just at the beginning, go through the script, check for where it says give examples, check for where it says underline, put a cross on this somewhere, I don't know. Just make sure that you don't lose those points. Other questions? Can you pass it through, please?
I've got a question concerning the IPA symbols. Do we only have to describe the symbols or the phoneme, the sound, or do we also have to be able to transcribe from normal words like map into phonemes?
I will not ask you to produce a transcription of longer stretches of words. No. Okay. No. In the same way as I don't ask you to draw trees, but you need to be able to read it. I might be giving you a word and asking questions about it, and if it's in IPA transcription, then you need to be able to know what it means. Okay, other questions? I'm getting hungry. No? This is your last chance. As I said, I'm not going to be here during the exam. I will be available for questions from the people invigilating just before the exam starts. I'm going to be available on Skype. So if there are any practical issues, then I should be able to deal with them. There are a number of people who have received emails from Frau Thielen or Heiko Zimmermann or others regarding the fact that they have not submitted assignments that they need to have in order to be allowed to take the exam. Some of these people never responded. I think in the meantime they have been told that they will be deleted from the list, to which they still haven't responded. If you feel that this might be the case for you, I think it would be a good idea to check your UniTrier account. Because this might be a misunderstanding. And in that case, we would like to solve it. Mm-hmm. But we assume that you read your email. It's the only way we can get hold of you. We cannot write an email to all people who have signed up for an exam. It's not possible in the system. It would be nice if we could do this, but we can't. Any other questions?